Going beyond the headlines to the deeper issues. 96.3 WHUR and HUR Voices, Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Insight Segment, where your questions and comments matter at 202-319-7810. Join the conversation.
Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Insight Segment. I'm Harold Fisher. When it comes to Washington, D.C. and the ever-shifting racial statistics of its population, gentrification is always a topic of discussion. That's not new. What is new is a report released this week about that, telling us in detail what we've long suspected, that D.C. is the most gentrified city in America. How did this happen, and what does it mean for the city's residents? My guests tonight are Jason Richardson, Director of Research at the National Community Reinvestment Coalition, which authored this report, Dr. Sabia Prince, urban anthropologist and with Empower DC, and Bo Sampson, business owner of the VIP Room in Northeast D.C. Lines are open at 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. You can tweet us using the hashtag WHURFM. Thank you all for joining me. I appreciate it. Thank you. Right.
Thanks for having us.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good, good. Let me start with this. The report is titled Shifting Neighborhoods, Gentrification and Cultural Displacement in American Cities. It is talking not just about D.C., but several cities in the United States. But this is the thing that I found very striking. Between 2000 and 2013, more than 20,000 African Americans have been displaced as a result of gentrification in the District of Columbia. Jason, how do you know that?
Well, first of all, we have member groups all over the country. So this is – we actually looked at 935 different cities, and that's important because when I say that D.C. had the most intense gentrification that we saw, what I mean is compared to over 900 other cities out there. And what we see when we look at data from 2000 through 2013 is that we looked first at neighborhoods that were eligible to gentrify, which we define as being in the lower 40th percentile in terms of income and home values. And then we looked to see how many of those saw sharp increases in those two statistics and college attainment, because those are – it's kind of a way that we can measure gentrification. So we took a look at that first. And then we were able to identify that about 40% of the neighborhoods in D.C. that were eligible to gentrify actually did during the study period that we looked at. And that was just 2000 through 2013. So we're talking about a few years back at this point, right? And then we also took a look at the people that lived in those neighborhoods. And we can use census data to understand what the racial composition was. So when we saw neighborhoods where we'd seen a particular racial group drop in their absolute number, and also they became a much smaller percentage of the people living there, then we could say that they were displaced. You know, we understand then that a new group of people came in, and the people who were living there left. And because they're of a different race and the census gives us information on the racial composition of each neighborhood, we can know, is that displacement of black? Is it Latino? Is it Asian? Or is it white? D.C. was almost exclusively African-American displacement. And that, you know, is how we came up with the 20,000 number. Nationally, you know, we found about 135,000 people were displaced, 20,000 of them, though, we're in the district.
That is a big number. Dr. Prince, your take on that number and what is happening? Why is gentrification happening in D.C.?
Well, gentrification, thanks for having us.
Sure.
Gentrification is a policy issue. So, you know, it occurs in communities that don't have the same wealth and don't have the same income. So there's a level of vulnerability there that subjects people to the gentrification piece. If you don't have the wealth to do things like sit on an empty building for decades until the market changes, if you don't have parents who can subsidize your presence, because there's wealth inequality that's been multiple generations long. If you don't have the same level of income, these are the factors that can make you vulnerable to gentrification. But we have to understand that it is a policy issue. It's not something that just naturally occurs through various sorts of shifts. So there's policies that have made these communities blighted, if you will, and then there are other policies that result in the influx of money, followed by the people who have access to the money.
Some people would argue that one person's gentrification is another person's urban renewal. What do you think about that?
I think that that may be true to some people, but we like to look at the conditions that people are actually living under, rather than be philosophical. So this is very much data-based.
What do you mean by that?
That people are experiencing displacement, that mm-hmm. they're experiencing homelessness, they're experiencing alienation, and those are real. So I would say one key way to think about this is that gentrification is a form of uneven development. Mm-hmm. So that there are some folks that are going to be happy with it, there's some folks who are going to benefit, and then there are other people that are not. So it's an uneven sort of a situation.
Yeah. And I was going to say, going into this, we've started working on this about a year and a half ago, and going into this, we recognized early on that it's very difficult to assign an empirical grade to a neighborhood that's saying it's gentrified, because gentrification is kind of a subjective term. You know, what one person considers gentrification, another one might see renewal. And what we learned was that we could present the data, but we really needed to rely on local communities to define what they wanted their community to look like. And if it was gentrification, that they would need to get involved locally and use our data to campaign to keep, you know, the existing incumbent residents where they were, to help business owners stay in business, right, and still invite investment in.
Bo Sampson, you own the VIP room in Northeast D.C. You've been on this program before. You've been fighting with newcomers.
That's right.
To the community. And I think the last time you were here was about 2 years ago.
Yes.
You are still fighting this.
Still fighting.
Fighting this fight. Briefly sum up for me what you think your issue is about.
Well, I'm going to sum it up. It's a family business, VIP room. Been there 40 years. We rent out for birthday parties, anniversary. We celebrate your life if you leave. So it's not a bar, restaurant, or club. So we went for an alcohol license. We got the alcohol license. And they put certain rules that we cannot grow our business.
Who is they?
The alcohol board had certain rules. Mm-hmm. And then we had to go to the zoning board to try to get those rules to make it even rules. Because there are 50 other Tavern C licenses in our area that have different rules than we do. So in order for us to grow our business, we have to have the same rules. So we went for a modification with the ANC's approval. We got 100% of the vote that we can change the modification of taking money at the door, doing a cash bar.
And let me say, I don't want to get too much into the weeds of this, because some people would just say, okay, you've owned this business, your family's owned this business for 40 years.
Yes.
And up until recently, you haven't had a problem. When I say recently, over the past several years. What happened?
The people moved in. Some people moved in, and they pretty much have been harassing us, from hate crime writing on our wall, sending letters down to the zoning board setting that we selling drugs and urinating in people's yards, trying to create havoc so they can find a way to get us out of the neighborhood, you know, doing different things. And we haven't gotten fair treatment. You know, the community, majority of the community is there. Even the white people like us, but there's a certain group of whites that use the black people to do the dirty work, plant bottles, they planted people in front of our facilities acting like they drunk. So what they ultimately want, in my opinion, is the building. It has nothing to do with drinking, because everybody, McDonald's getting ready to sell alcohol, Chuck E. Cheese sell it, the hockey game. So it's not about the alcohol. It's about they want to move us out so they can do what they want to do. You see sidewalk bars. I mean, that you can smoke marijuana at your house and grow it in the backyard. So we feel that we don't have the same rules, and we want everybody to come down April 3rd. And this is not just for the VIP room. This is for the churches, for the businesses, and come down there and show support for us, because there's a public hearing that we already got the ruling for. They want to try us again.
So real quick, that public hearing, you said it's on April 3rd.
Yes.
Is this the city council?
It's the zoning board.
Zoning board.
They already voted 100% in our favor. Mm-hmm. Now they want to retry us.
Okay.
Like it's the Al Gore, George Bush thing. They want to recount the votes.
Now,
what I'm saying?
Now you're telling your age. There you go. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are talking about gentrification, and a new report by the National Community Reinvestment Coalition, which is, the report says that D.C. is the most gentrified city in America, something that anecdotally a lot of people suspected, but now we have some really hard numbers. We're going to take your phone calls coming up next. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Jay, calling from District Heights, you're up next. Please don't hang up. And as always, those calls come even after 7:30 on Sirius XM. So please stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Jeff Brown is next with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR. This conversation continues on Sirius XM Channel 141 in just a few seconds. That number one more time, 202-319-7810. We'll be back in just a moment.
The Howard University Radio Network is WHUR 96.3 FM, WHUR World 96.3 HD2, student-run WHBC HD3, GlassHouseRadio.com, SiriusXM Channel 142, HBCU and SiriusXM Channel 141, HUR Voices, Washington.
Welcome back to the Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We are talking about gentrification in the District of Columbia and a new report about it here and in other cities around the nation. My guests are Jason Richardson, Director of Research at the National Community Reinvestment Coalition, which authored the report. Also, Sabia Prince, urban anthropologist with Empower DC, and Bo Sampson, a business owner of the VIP room in Northeast DC. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Jay, calling from District Heights. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, gentrification is a result of, one, poverty and the lack of the criminal enforcement that take place. You always get a reactionary response from the police department after somebody's murdered. But you don't hear about the murders in Upper Northwest. You don't hear about the murders in parts of Southwest where the development and areas like that are. What you hear about is people responding after people have been killed. Now, if you had the same police presence in Southeast as you do in Northwest, then you wouldn't have the problem of murders at the rate that they are. You can't come on TV after somebody's baby is dead from guys jumping out of a car, you know, shooting a little girl based on the fact that it wasn't enough boots on the ground, you know, in community policing.
Well, Jay, let me see if my guests can react to that. Please, go right ahead, Jason.
Well, I want to touch on the first thing you said. You talked about poverty, and this is, I think, an important point, and I want to touch on Bo here as well, because I was talking to you before the show, and you own your building.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Yeah. In a lot of the areas there, you know, what we found, you know, by looking at other studies and diving into it, was that generally the ownership rate is very low in a lot of these communities because they're low income, values are low, not a lot of lending going on there, mortgage lending and things like that, very difficult to get small business loans. So a lot of times when you see this gentrification come through, not only do the population are mostly renting, because they can't afford to buy, or they just don't have the wealth to do so. But also, the business owners are often renting their spaces as well. That leaves both of those populations much more vulnerable to being pushed out and not reap any of the benefits of the influx of investment. So, I mean, Bo, luckily they own their own building that they're in at the VIP room. But and so, if, you know, if he was to go to sell, at least they would be able to get that benefit of selling the property. If he didn't own that, I would suggest that he, you know, probably this fight would have been a lot shorter that you're having. Would you agree?
Yes, I think so, because they have other tactics to do. You know, the fact that we own it, my father was way ahead of the game, man. You know, back before he passed away, 2011, and he saw the vision of property. People were moving out. My mom wanted to go out to the suburbs, you know, and my friends following them. My father said, "No, we need to stay right here," and it came back. Because my father really got his business because of the riots. A lot of people don't know that.
In 68.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And it happened to other businesses where they sold it to the people because they were scared of the riots. And that's how my father originally got his vacuum cleaner business and then moved on to the VIP room.
Jay, thank you so much for your phone call. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Sandra calling from D.C., what's on your mind?
You know, really what I have is a question.
Sure.
For the guest speaker. In all the talks about regentrification, I've never heard anybody say why necessary, or not really why, but how would such a large group of another race of people come together and all of them be on the same page all over the United States to meet and map out their plan to systematically, I guess, do the regentrification in all of these cities where African Americans have been displaced.
Well, let me see if Dr. Prince can answer that, because what you're suggesting is really remarkable and quite fascinating, because on the surface of it, that's what it looks like. It almost looks like a whole bunch of white folks got together and just moved in and moved the black folks out. Is that true?
Well, it's less of a conspiracy and more of a reflection of racial inequality, right? So the people that have the jobs that are allowing them to purchase the property in D.C., which is one of the most expensive cities in our country right now, it's like top 10 in terms of the income that you have to rent a two-bedroom. So what we're seeing is that the folks who have these jobs have now made a conscious decision to reside in the city as opposed to commuting from the suburbs. Mm-hmm. So they are building community. They are forming a new way of life. So it really is a reflection of the fact that they have the higher income jobs. They also have the wealth accumulated that allows them to purchase property, allows them to renovate property, etc. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're seeing. It's not super complicated. It is a part of our racial history in this country.
And Jason mentioned one other piece: education. Because when you spoke at the top of the show, when you were talking about those communities that were eligible for gentrification, and you said that the education level went up.
Yeah.
And I think that goes along with what Dr. Prince was saying.
It does. So we didn't develop the methodology for measuring gentrification. There's a body of work out there that kind of, you know, developed that over time. But one of the measurements is looking at did the level of college education in that neighborhood dramatically increase? And that's just one of the tests that we use to measure for gentrification. And that's a measurement, I think, though, of the income potential that education imparts, you know, on people. So they're more likely to have more wealth. They're more likely to have a higher income if they have more education. I mean, that's kind of a well-known, you know, correlation there on the average, right? So yeah, that's how I think they relate. You know, one thing I did want to say, you know, kind of to go back out again to more of a national kind of scale. Sabia was talking about the movement of people inward in cities. And what we've seen is a lot of cities where downtown or industrialized areas were kind of, you know, shut down over the past generation, and a lot of those areas have been rehabbed or the factories have been torn down. They've brought in green spaces and they've built housing, and this is kind of a movement of wealthier people into mm-hmm. those spaces. Baltimore is a good example. Inner Harbor of Baltimore, that Fells Point, that whole area there,
Harbor East and the like. Yeah,
Here in D.C., Southwest. Right around, with the new baseball stadium and the soccer field and all of that. That's all, now drawing people in to an area that was formerly more of an industrial use, right? Mm-hmm. So, I think that's a pattern we're seeing nationally, but we're also seeing it here.
Sandra, thank you so much for your phone call. Let me go to Olivia calling from Southeast D.C. Olivia, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Good evening, everyone.
Hey.
It's a pleasure to get an opportunity to speak with you, but I think that there's one element that is totally, totally amiss in our conversation, because there are elements that the quote-unquote local government comes into play, and I'll give you an example.
Make it quick. I've got a lot of folks on the line, but go ahead.
Okay, but there's an example. The government plays with the property tax. And I see, especially in more impoverished neighborhoods, the seniors that have been there the whole time are on a fixed income. So they are getting outpriced because they can't afford the property tax. We are always dealing with the issue of the unequal distribution of wealth. So when the government comes and plays with the property tax, that interferes with all levels of the local community.
Interesting. Bo, you wanted to... Thank you so much, Olivia. You wanted to say something about that,
yeah.
Bo?
Yeah. It's real funny because there's other tactics they're doing. If you go to the parking meter, man, someplace you got to use your credit card. Some people might not have good credit to have a credit card.
Unbanked communities.
And you go into restaurants. That's the new thing. You go down to the Anthem downtown. They don't take no cash. So a lot of people might not... They might have been operating on a different type of business model. Then also I want to point out, I hate to say it, but some of the white people, they find some black people to do the dirty work to make it look like it's not.
What do you mean by that?
I guess just like with our example, the VIP room, they planted bottles, we ain't open, they graffitied our place.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm.
And it was always the black people that were in the front. There's a lady around the, around town that she's 85 years old passing flyers out. Now she might not even be able to get a date. 85, and she passing flies out talking about some alcohol, mm-hmm. But the point that I'm making is sometimes they use other tactics mm-hmm. other than just the norm stuff you don't see mm-hmm. underground.
I have a question, because something else struck me that Bo said earlier. He said that some members of his family wanted to leave the city and move out to the suburbs. And I pose this question from the perspective of, even for the black people who have the means to stay, to redo, to renovate, as we have seen happen in LaDroid Park, as we have seen which is just south of Howard University, for those of you who are listening outside of the D.C. metro, or those who lived south of Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, mm-hmm. where those places were boarded up, and just maybe 10 or 15 years ago, they were selling those places for a song in exchange for agreements that you would fix it up. But you have black flight, because black folks want new. They don't want to rehab. And so they leave. And what, as we've seen in LaDroid Park, we see white people come in with the means, with the credit, with the financing to turn these old homes into their original grandeur. Mm-hmm. How much responsibility does the black community have for some of this?
I would say just a few things about that. One, the big thrust of black outmigration historically took place after 1968. Mm-hmm. So that was after the riots.
My parents included. Because we were in D.C. after the riots, yes, we moved out
and
to Prince George's County. Yes.
There was a reason, because people felt vulnerable.
But I'm talking about over the last 10 or 15 years. I'm not talking about 68.
Well, let me add something to this, because I'm a social scientist, and I caution us about individualizing this conversation, right? I mean, let's zoom out. Because
this is a
structural issue, and there's a contextual sort of thing that we're talking about. So, you know, I don't get into the personal choices that people make. People can live wherever they want. You know, it really is about the overarching power structure that we have. And so black people have, you know, moved out for a variety of different reasons, primarily because, as you say, they wanted larger homes because things were more affordable. Mm-hmm. So those are economic pressures that really have pushed people out.
Or economic choices. Like you said, and they are free to make those choices. If you want new and you can afford it, you are certainly free to do that.
Well, yeah, but the housing is very expensive in D.C., and it's not comparable to where people are moving to.
Let me go back to the phone lines real quick. Let me talk to Butch, calling from Fort Washington, out in those suburbs. Butch, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
How's everybody doing today?
Just fine.
I'm not a fan of gentrification, but I am a fan of revitalization. And I honestly think that not just D.C., but Maryland needs to have some type of oversight committee to find out what's going on and why these people are being displaced, and then get a hold on it, because a similar situation happened to my mom. My mom has been living in D.C. for 40 years, owns her house right out. Somebody came to her and told her that she didn't owe, her taxes wasn't up to par, and that she was made to need to sell her house. We found out that that was all wrong. It was illegal and everything. Mm-hmm. We fought it. My mom still has her house. So a lot of these people who are old don't have the resources or the knowledge or the know-how to even know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
So we really need to get some type of oversight committee in place, not just for D.C., but for Maryland also, to see what's really going on. And I just want to say hi to Bo, too. He's my good friend.
Oh, hey. Hey, how you doing?
Thank you so much, Butch. Bo, go right ahead real quick.
I'm going to take it off the VIP. I'm going to go to the churches. They changed the zoning laws to the churches downtown. If you can't park, you can't go to church. Can't go to church. Can't put no money in the pot. Can't put no money in your pot, can't pay the bills, the developers coming all over the city. Then you go all around D.C., ain't nobody is in the building. So why you keep building up houses? Ain't nobody can afford them or rent them. You saw on TV, on the news the other night, the people were, and you were right there, right? You tell us about what happened.
What?
You talk with the housing. Oh, I lost you, Harold.
Yeah, you lost me. I'll ask the questions on this one. But to your point, and you brought up a really critical point. This isn't just about businesses, and this isn't just about housing. One of the biggest sore points is with houses of worship, where longstanding churches and other houses of worship in the district with people of color have been put in a position of not being able to find parking. There are bicycle lanes and the like. Please, Jason, talk about that.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned churches. So my senior researcher, Bruce Mitchell, one of the early indications he had that D.C. would be interesting to look at for us was the Lincoln Temple in Shaw, which closed last year. And you're talking about a church with a long, very important history. And it closed not because the congregation was – or not because the church itself was in trouble. They closed because the congregation had left, and they had tried to appeal to the new residents of Shaw and build a rebuild the congregation, and apparently were not successful. And so, you know, that was one of the first things that kind of gave us a little clue that D.C. might really stand out in some way. That out migration that you're talking about. I do want to disagree a little bit with you when we talk about, you know, where people want to live. What we found in my team primarily researches credit and mortgage credit, you know, small business lending and patterns of lending and investment. And we've done a lot of work in a lot of cities, including D.C. and Baltimore. And what we tend to find is that loans don't tend to happen in neighborhoods that are both poor and minority. And I'm talking about mortgage lending specifically, but also small business lending and other forms of lending. So for your neighborhood like LaJoie Park, you know, at a certain point, it would have been primarily low-income minority. It would have been very difficult to get a loan there. In my research, you know, I'm looking through court records. You rarely see actual mortgages in low-income minority neighborhoods before even the 90s. It just wasn't very common. So what happens is, you know, the people who live there, they can get a mortgage on a place in PG County, or they can get a mortgage in Montgomery County or Fairfax when they couldn't get one in D.C. And we've seen a lot of this with West Baltimore as well, you know, next to Howard County. Low-income families can find a mortgage much easier in surrounding areas because the neighborhood is more attractive to lenders. When that happens, then you've got families who have existing money, who can draw on other sources of wealth, who are going to be largely white, moving into those neighborhoods because they can afford to buy the place for cash or put down a very large down payment and then get a smaller mortgage. And they're going to have an easier time doing that and then put money into the rehab and everything like that. That requires – that kind of home ownership requires a substantial amount of wealth. It's cheaper to buy a new house, right? Because you can just put down a little bit. You can get a good mortgage. It's already, you don't have to rehab it.
It's a whole lot easier to hang a couple of pictures than to take 30 layers of lead paint off of a burl walnut spiral staircase in one of these places that's 100 years old.
I've done both, and I can tell you which one's easier.
Yeah, absolutely. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Jason calling from Northwest. Thanks for hanging on, Jason. What's on your mind?
Yes, hi. Good evening, everyone. I just want to add to the conversation that's going on there that another aspect of this gentrification is that there's a lot of flipping going on. You have people coming in, a lot of developers coming in, buying up property, from the residents that live there, and then turning around and then selling it at a huge profit. And then a lot of times they hold on to it for a few years, and then they again sell it to another white person. Therefore, causing a lot of instability into the neighborhood. Then they rent out these properties to lowlifes, and then that's why you have a lot of criminal activity going on in certain areas because these people that are actually buying the property, they don't always actually live there.
But let me stop you there, Jason, because I was with you until you mentioned the so-called lowlifes, as you say, because that's not what's happening. And help me here if I'm incorrect, Jason, but with gentrification, while you may have some people that are flipping, the people that are buying these places, or they may be renting them at I would argue that you can't be a lowlife at $3,000 a month for a one bedroom. So let me see what my guests have to say. Well, your thoughts about that, Dr. Prince?
Well, they're all kind of lowlives at various income levels. Yeah. So, but that's really not the point. I think my key observation is that communities are being destroyed. People's sense of belonging is being undermined, and their social networks are being demolished. And what that does, particularly for low-income people, is it makes them profoundly vulnerable because people rely on each other. And that's the beautiful part about community. And particularly if you are low-income, you need your neighbors. So I can recall interviewing people, sitting around the kitchen table, talking to folks. You know, someone knocks on the door, "Miss So-and-so, I'm on my way to the store. Can I get you some medicine?" I mean, you know, there's a sense of belonging that people
have. And community.
And community. Yeah. Yeah. It's quite important.
Yeah. Jason, thank you so much for your phone call. Lisa, calling from Southeast D.C. Thanks for calling, Lisa. What's on your mind? Lisa, are you there? Give me a call back. Keisha, calling from D.C.,
Hi.
Yes, go right ahead.
Mm-hmm. Hi, thank you. This is Kaisha Davis calling from Washington, D.C. and Southeast. Yes, I can say as a Ward 8 resident that I have and my mom has experienced gentrification at its finest. My mom resides at the 4300 block of 3rd Street, Southeast. They underwent $1 million of renovations. Calling the mayor's office, I've called Trayon's office. I've even spoke with Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton to ask me, what does she want me to do on a federal level? My issues is that they purposely, in communities of low income, underprivileged people, believe that they don't want better. And so, but also it relies on the residents too. You have to demand better. And as I've seen with this process of what they're doing with the renovations, there's no level of accountability. They're giving millions of dollars in funds to these developers and slumlords, as I call them, and no one is doing anything about it. Like I said, it's the 4300 block of 3rd Street Southeast. They renovated. They gave new carpet and appliances, but people are still complaining of sewage backup, gas leaks on top of. I've called the news station, every last station. No one can say that they don't know my name, my mom's name, the community name. No one will come out to do an interview. Since then, back in September, two buildings were for families were placed in a hotel due to gas leaking issues.
Kaisha, I am really low on time, and can you kind of sum up your point real quick? Because
my point is that if people don't become homeowners and realize their home ownership in D.C. and particularly in Ward 7 and 8, then they're going to get displaced, and they have to take part in coming out to vote and holding their elected officials accountable.
Okay, so thank you. Thank you so much, Kaisha. That's what I said. And that's what I was saying. You can, on one hand, you can move where you want. You want to move to Fort Washington? Move to Fort Washington. You want to move to Woodmore? Move to Woodmore. You want to move to Alexandria, Old Town, or Falls Church? You can do that. But Kaisha's point is, if you want those generational communities, if you want to go knock on that door and not have Uncle Sam ask Miss Jones if she needs something from the store, but you want to have Uncle Sam's son come by and ask, or his son's son generationally, then those choices also have to do with that.
I like this. Okay, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I'm very sorry, Kaisha, what you're experiencing. And I like your fighting spirit. And may I suggest one thing that we all can do is that we can all organize. I am a staff member.
That was
member.
My next question. How do you address this?
I'm a staff member at Empower DC. Empower DC has been in existence since 2003, building community power, organizing working class families. So I think folks speaking with one voice, coming together collectively to be a thorn in the side of the people that are pushing these kind of policies, that is one way that we can see some change.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Bo. How should this be addressed?
Oh, another thing. People got to go to the meetings. Like we at the ANC meetings, we got to go out. Our people are not at those meetings. I go all the time, but we got to increase that visibility. Mm-hmm. And then you got to network with other people, because my business will not be in business if people don't support it, and it's community orientated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and real quick, so National Community Reinvestment Coalition, we actually provide research support and data support to about 600 different member groups, and we help groups like Empower DC build coalitions of other groups that all work together. And you know, that's kind of a high level organizing that can help with this situation, and again can help push back and keep. And one of the earlier callers mentioned that there was a difference between revitalization and gentrification, and I think he's absolutely right. But if you want your revitalization to benefit the people that live there, organize. Find a local group like Empower DC, and if you're in a local group already, talk to us and the NCRC, and we can help you build a coalition that's far more powerful than you on your own.
Do you think that this 20,000 from 2000 to 2013, do you see that those numbers increasing
yep.
at a even faster pace?
Yeah, I'm not ready to say faster. We've taken some look at the preliminary data from more recent years, and it certainly appears that the process continued. I'm not far enough along in it to really say for sure that yes, it's accelerated, but I certainly don't think that it has stopped or slowed down.
Mm-hmm. Unless I'll let Dr. Prince have the last word. What do you see as the future for Black people in this city as this issue is continuing to bubble up on one hand, but we still see thousands and thousands still moving out? Is there a nexus at some point? What needs to happen?
I'll do this. I'm going to put on my optimist cap, which I don't often wear.
No doubt.
I'm putting that on to say that perhaps people will come together and organize and push back. It is a dire situation. But I do think that we can do, you know, something to stave this off. And I think people are getting more woke, if you will. So we're understanding what's going on. There is corporate welfare. There are subsidies of corporations and developers. And so that needs to stop. And that could help to undermine some of what we're seeing right now. We need to push back against this privatization and understand that it's generations of wealth inequality that have made us vulnerable to this.
So. Real quick, Bo.
Real quick. I just met these two great researchers, experts, and we all three are going to get together and put something together for everybody. And we'll let you know, Harold.
Please keep me posted, Bo. Good to see you again. Thank you so much. Good luck to you, Dr. Prince and Sabia Prince. I'm going to get that.
That might be a nickname, huh?
We're going to keep that doctor right in front because she earned it. And Jason Richardson, thank you so much. I really appreciate you coming in.
This was great.
Thank you for having us.
Absolutely. Oh, that is the Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141 for this Friday, March 22nd. For News Director Renee Nash, reporters Taylor Thomas, Malek Green, Bramante Bryant, producer Candace Atkins, and engineer Bobby Adams, I'm Harold Fisher. You can tweet us using the hashtag WHURFM. Now stay tuned for The Connection. Good night and have a wonderful weekend.